Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is October 2nd, 2014. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Well, events have been busy. We just had a great lunch with subscribers in Albuquerque on September 24th. I want to thank everyone, particularly the Solari Report subscriber who helped organize it. It's a perfect example of somebody saying, come on into my town. We've gotten some invitations from some wonderful subscribers, and we're going to be doing more this year and next year as well. But this was one that was particularly wonderful, and I just want to thank everybody involved. It was remarkable to see how many wonderful subscribers we had in that area, and people came in from Colorado and Arizona, so it was quite lovely. We have mailed invitations to our Menlo Park event. That's south of San Francisco, right next to Palo Alto and Stanford University. It's going to be on the weekend of November 8th and 9th. You can access your invitation if you're a subscriber, you're listening to this, by logging into the blog, and you'll see the logo and the post up on the left at the top of the blog. So if you're interested, please take a look. This is going to be an amazing event. We still have some places open, but what is remarkable is that the most fascinating and knowledgeable people in our network are coming. We have people coming from Australia, the UK, Holland. Jeroen van Straten, who was the organizer of the Secret Space Conference, is coming all the way back over. So that's going to be amazing. Subscriber from New Zealand, Illinois, Massachusetts, Wisconsin, Michigan, Tennessee, California, several members of the San Francisco Bay Area Solari Circle, I'm hoping, are coming. So it's going to be, it's a remarkable group of people. I'm very, very thrilled about that. And then finally, we're working on organizing a dinner, a Christmas dinner in New York in the second Saturday in December. If we pull it off, Richard Dolan will be our guest speaker. And I'm also going to try and get Eunice Boston, who did our wonderful, wonderful Solari Report on cleaning, and some of her partners to come and join us for dinner. So I'm hoping that that gets organized, and that'll give you folks on the East Coast a chance to come together and meet. That's the best thing about these events is all the subscribers getting the opportunity to meet each other and network together. It's always remarkable to see their faces when they find out there's so many attractive, intelligent people just like them. Our theme tonight is the shift to 3.0, and we're going to be looking at 12 trends. This is our third quarter wrap-up. As you know, every quarter we step back, try and get the long view. I think that's very important. This was inspired because we decided to do in November for our equity quarterly overview a discussion of investment strategy for Global 3.0, and then part of that was going to be the top trends. As you know, I think it's important to try and align with the primary trends where it makes sense to. It doesn't always make sense, and it may not always be what I find the responsible thing to do. But I think it's important to know what the trends are and to align with them where you line up. So we decided to do that for the wrap-up, and I'm very glad I did because it has been a tremendous effort to pull together what we normally do each wrap-up. We do a comic book with pictures and graphs and other information. So if you go to the blog, you will see on the blog post for this evening's wrap-up a link to the third quarter 2014 wrap-up comic book, and I would really encourage you to go there and follow along using the comic book because I think it will help tremendously. This wrap-up is one I'm very excited about. I have gotten some input on it. When I was driving to San Francisco, I stopped and visited with Dr. Joseph Farrell, and we had quite a conversation. And the thing that was very, I just went through the outline with him. It was before I had the comic book finished. And we went through the different areas, and it's very integrating when you step back and look at the long-term trends and where things are going. And suddenly lots of different disparate stories in the news that seem sort of weird and incoherent come together, and you see where these things are going. And what was very exciting for me was walking him through the outline helped him do that. And he posted a blog post several days ago about it. So I thought I'd just kick off and read you some of what he wrote, because it's one of the most important things I really want you to understand from the wrap-ups this year, including this one. And that's where the technology is taking the global currency system. Anyway, he titled the blog post, and I'm only going to read excerpts. Astro Mining, U.S. Congress considers bill and some high-octane speculation. He writes, recently I had a fascinating conversation with former Assistant Secretary of HUD, Catherine Austin Fitz, and the subject of our conversation was, as it often is, space and global finance and the links between the two. So then he jumps in. Let me just jump in. Quote, if the U.S. wants its private space industry to jump into the fray, argues so-and-so, legislators must create a more predictable environment in which companies can enjoy the rights of their extraction or to extract without interference. In other words, like it or not, we are entering the age of space commercialization. Over the next 2 to 3 generations, this will dramatically transform the culture we live in. Excellent point. So how to minimize risk and protect investment? And then he goes into the currency system, and here's the important part, and I want you to listen to this carefully. There are basically two routes here, and here's why Secretary Fitz's insight comes in. And as we worked our way through the conversation and her charts and graphs, we both became rather speechless and breathless at what might possibly be going on. One way would be the way of international treaty and negotiation, a long and tiresome process, as the principal problem to be encountered is what standard of law would be the ultimate arbitrator of such commercial ventures, he means in space. The other way would be the creation of a global government brought about perhaps by a tender for the global population, which would be the Chancellor Kohl scheme for the reunification of Germany writ large and on a global scale. You'll recall that this scheme was both cunning and shrewd in its simplicity. As the former Democratic Republic of Germany, East Germany, began to fall apart, Chancellor Kohl allowed a one-for-one currency tender of East German marks for the much stronger West German D-mark. As East Germans began to use the D-mark, the economies slided together, and the deal was done. Now, how might one go about doing this on a global basis? Think Chancellor Kohl plus smartphones, Apple Pay, and other virtual currencies, global tender. Voila! So he saw the play. Okay, so let's step back a little bit and revisit sort of where we are in this discussion of global 2.0 to 3.0. As I described in the annual wrap-up, and there are links in the comic book to both the annual wrap-up and the two quarterly wrap-ups so far this year, I talked about a shift in the economy. So let's go back to the beginning of the 90s and the creation of the World Trade Organization and a decision using very much new telecommunications and digital technology to rebalance the global economy, shift capital out of the G7 nations, reinvest, including in the emerging markets, and shift capital into what we're, Joseph and I, refer to as the breakaway civilization. And what that does is it kicks off a process where we really are becoming one global economy, despite all the fractiousness that you're seeing. And we're creating a world where literally everyone is on the internet and can connect directly with everyone else. And I described one of my favorite quotes from Michael Ventura describing what this means. He said, the human psyche is one of the great forces of nature, and what is most frightening about this space-time technology is that it exposes us to this force within us as nothing else ever has. We're standing in the storm of our own being. Well, the psychic storm is now growing to 7 billion. We're about halfway to 7 billion people, all connected online, able to communicate directly with each other. So that's quite a psychic storm. And, you know, step one is a global psychic storm. And as part of that, a global economy and all sorts of global things happening going on. So what that means is we're going from an industrial economy where G7 ruled the roost and the emerging markets provided economy, our natural resources, to G7, which was in control, to something that's much more balanced, where productivity and or production and consumption is much more balanced globally. And so we're going from an industrial economy 2.0 to a networked economy 3.0. And to be perfectly honest, nobody quite knows what that's going to look like. What I will tell you is during the financial coup d'etat, which was basically the 90s through the the bailouts, what you had was a great deal of capital shifted out. And now that capital, with the bailouts over and the trail gone cold, the liability shredded or covered up, and the paper trail certainly shredded, that money is free to be reinvested. And it's an enormous amount of resources. And of course, the question for all of us is where is it going to be reinvested? So let's dive in, open up the comic book, and let's walk through the 12 trends and see if we can't get our perspective on some of that. I started off, of course, with the most important question to me, which is how can you live a free and inspired life in a world that is complex and rapidly changing? I've been very struck to see so many people in my generation, I'm a baby boomer, who are very angry about the change that's happened to date. And one of the reasons our poster for this year and our theme for this year was Breakaway is again and again and again, I want to keep bringing you back to the fact that the change we've seen in the financial coup, drawing the capital out and beginning the rebalance of the global economy is a small portion of the change we're about to go through. So I keep telling everybody, you know, you ain't seen nothing yet. Strap your, you know, put on your seatbelt, strap in, because we're about to hit warp drive. And I hope these 12 trends in this wrap up and all the wrap ups we've done this year help you make that shift successfully. Anyway, but my goal with this is to give you a better map so that you can sort of find and create your unique pathway, because there are a lot of opportunities. So let's just dive in. Trend number one, rebalancing the global economy. It started with the creation of the World Trade Organization, but it's far from over. I show a couple of great charts that show where now it's 7.2 billion people globally, and what you'll see is the births are significantly greater than the deaths, despite the fact that it seems like the leadership is doing a lot of things to increase the death rate. And what you'll see is in the developed world, our percent of consumption is shrinking and is expected to continue to shrink. And of course, that some of us sometimes find that depressing. I showed two polls that show in the emerging markets, everybody thinking, oh, they're getting better off and they're all happy and excited for the next generation. Whereas you look in the developed worlds and we're thinking, oh, the next generation is going to be worse off. And I showed one Gallup poll of the U.S. about how dissatisfied we are. If you want to get your perspective on the rebalancing, the best book I have seen for a long time, and we did an interview with the author and I recommended it strongly on the blog, is Steve Roach's book, Unbalanced, The Codependency of America and China. It's a great way to get your perspective. I have a wonderful member of our network who was flying to China and is going to be in China for a while. And I said, please read this book on the plane. And then we Skyped after she got over there and she said, oh, great book, great perspective. I can really, you know, see the events in context. Part of this global rebalancing, which is new and I think is now going to have a dramatic impact in what's ahead, is we now have a new generation coming into leadership positions everywhere from the late teens into the 30s, the millennial generation. We had Neil Howe on the Solari Report to discuss the millennial generation, and I encourage you to go back and listen. But we now have a generation of young people who are global. They're savvy with digital technology. They can connect and transact, communicate and travel globally. And they're a wholly different generation than Gen X and the baby boomers above them. And they're now coming into leadership positions. And I think they're going to have, this is our first big global generational shift. And I think it's going to make it very interesting. So watch for their impact to start to really be felt in both the consciousness and the marketplace. So the rebalancing the global economy, remember, it's far from over. This is going to be decades. And it's going to be quite interesting. Finance and investment trend two. We are transforming to 3.0, and it's going to be quite dazzling. The first part of this is I pointed out that the World Federation of Exchanges have reported that global equity market capitalization has now risen almost to $70 trillion. It's important to remember in the beginning of the 90s, it was only $9 trillion. So it's multiplied by over almost 700% or more. And it's important to remember that back in the 1990s, many countries didn't have stock market exchanges. Or if they did, they were quite tiny in amount. And we're going through a process where in 1990, a very small portion of the financial assets and the actual assets and economic activity, we're going from a world where a very small percentage of that is expressed and traded in the stock market to literally a very high percent around the globe that will be. And part of that is now exchange-traded funds have created liquid access for Western investors to invest in a broad selection of emerging markets, emerging equity markets. So if I want to invest in companies in Vietnam or Indonesia or Singapore, buying the individual stocks would be too illiquid. Buying funds in that country could be very cumbersome for a variety of reasons, but exchange-traded funds allow me to invest in a broad selection of the companies in that market and do it on a much more liquid basis. So that liquidity is growing, and it's moving us to a world where we can literally trade places. So I can buy Singapore, go short Hong Kong, you know, et cetera, and expect that trend to continue and go to more granular levels. We've talked both in the equity overviews as well as the wrap-ups about falling interest rates. To our shock and amazement, the best-performing asset class of the year so far is bonds and treasury bonds. Right now, we're living in a world where the U.S. dollar is flying up. But we continue to look around the world and look at the debt and derivatives load and think, how can this possibly continue? But it does. But it's quite a weight on the world and quite a weight on growth. And part of what you're seeing with growth is a world struggling under those over that debt and derivative. Anyway, one of the things that's happening in the finance area, which is most interesting, is if you look at the move to get global citizens on smartphones and on the internet, of course, what follows is the effort to get them transacting through those vehicles, so mobile payment systems, and moving onto the internet to do transactions. And the reality is the emerging market cannot possibly afford the spreads that are charged by whether it's developed world banks or credit cards or services like PayPal. We see with the IPO of Alibaba the intense interest in the amount of float that Alipay, which is not part of Alibaba, it's held off and separate private, but the amount of business that it does and how it transacts. And it's not surprising that as Alibaba comes out and raises with a very successful IPO, $25 billion, we see Apple announce Apple Pay, and then suddenly PayPal cutting its terms to sort of compete with Apple, and finally eBay throwing in the towel and spinning off PayPal. So in terms of mobile payment systems and internet payment systems, the last 2 weeks have been very, very interesting. The reality is if you look what's happening is as Google launches satellites and puts out its Google Wallet or Apple puts out Apple Pay, as Joseph said, we're looking for a variety of parties to tender for the global population through the smartphones and through their wallets or payment systems. And so what we're trying to do is bring those transaction costs way, way down, razor thin. And that's part of what's happening with the rise of Bitcoin and digital currencies. We're looking for ways of reaching that. And it's not surprising now with the squabble in Russia, you see Putin and some of the BRICS now talking about creating their own systems because there are real questions about the integrity of the online currency clearance and exchange systems. And I think everybody knows you are trying to tender for the global population through the currency. Anyway, the online platforms are popping up everywhere. One of the things that has been most interesting in the last couple of years is the U.S. market has just taken off up against the emerging markets. The emerging markets started to move up this year, and they've now backed off and kind of broken down again as the dollar has risen, which means the central bank intervention has certainly spread a lot of money that could go into sort of securitizing the global equity markets. But certainly the U.S. has been, or the U.S. market has been, the greatest beneficiary of that process. The hard thing for many of us, and as you watch many of the commentators looking to explain what's going on, the hard thing is when you have a financial system that is this centrally managed and highly leveraged, the variability of feasible scenarios, both for the markets and the currency systems, becomes wider and wider. In essence, you don't have price and pricing in different markets regrounding into fundamentals through the daily market action because you have so much intervention. And so there are a lot of big questions that could dramatically impact the sort of pathway that we take to securitizing the whole planet and moving to a global currency system. I laid out some of the questions in Trend 2. Where will the breakaway civilization reinvest their growing capital? How will the new global middle class invest their savings? Will Asia and the emerging market countries develop pension fund systems, and how will these institutions invest? Certainly in the last couple of years, we've seen enormous amounts of money flowing into the equity markets from both G7 and G20 institutions, both the sovereign wealth funds and central banks and big governmental institutions. And that has clearly supported the strength in the equity markets. And then finally, will growing cyber warfare and online financial fraud threaten the fundamental integrity of the financial system? Because as we're rapidly getting more and more dependent on these systems, their integrity is coming more and more under question. I also posted a roundup for the global markets for the year to date. Just to mention, in the recent week or two, we've been correcting in the U.S. stock market. And as the dollar rises, commodities and emerging markets have taken a pounding. My belief is that the long-term trend, certainly in the U.S. markets, is up. And this is, we're way overdue for a 10% to 20% correction. So I don't see anything on the horizon that would change this from being just a correction. There's been a lot of scare talk. I would be very careful. I would take all of that with a grain of salt. Certainly the guys in the commodities market are having a hard market, and I'm hoping that Franklin will join us next month and we can talk a little bit more about precious metals and sort of what's happening in commodities. I think the big question is how much will the settlement systems be bifurcated, and how much will the BRICS insist on getting, you know, sovereign control over their digital systems and digital cloud? And that brings us to our third trend, building out the global network, because behind all of this is the infrastructure, whether it's the smartphone that you and I use, or it's the digital telecommunications, or the cloud. One of the things that's happening with this much going online, and not just, you know, the individuals getting connected, but all sorts of devices and things getting connected, the Internet of the Things, is that it is giving tremendous support to the growth of what's called the cloud, which is storing your data out there in primarily corporate entities providing these services. And it has all sorts of ramifications. It makes this, you know, the questions about integrity and cyber warfare just get that much worse. One of the things that's clear is that social media is going to play a very significant role in intermediating out there on the internet. If 7 billion people are going to talk to each other, they're probably going to talk to each other through social media, although indications are the millennials still prefer email as a way of communication to social media. What you'll see if you look at the charts and some of the numbers that I've provided, social media is particularly explosive in China. It's very interesting to see how well the Chinese internet stocks have done, Alibaba, of course, being now the most famous. The power of this network of everything, the Internet of Things and people being connected, is going to be turbocharged as we start to find different ways of accessing. I put up an article about Samsung creating demoing a way for a tablet to be controlled by your brain. So if you can imagine communicating telepathically with your smartphone or your tablet, it'll give you an idea of what's ahead. And obviously the implications for privacy, for systems integrity, for the integrity of your own mind is dramatic. Not the least of which is a big concern of mine. You know, whenever I want to buy a book and I really value the book, I buy a paper copy. I don't buy a digital copy because I think the combination of the cloud and these kinds of systems raises real questions about the possibility for manipulating knowledge and, you know, changing the text and books and Lord knows what else. So very big troubling questions, but also if you look at the numbers of where we are in the process, I think the train has left the station. And a lot of the debate is going to be the kinds we're seeing with the BRIC nations and Putin demanding digital control and sovereignty within the cloud, within their territory. Trend number four, reengineering delivery, succeeding in atoms and bits. And I keep pounding the drum about this idea of atoms, bits and atoms. So let me just read you the beginning. As people and objects are networked, the ways in which goods and services are produced and distributed are dramatically reengineered. Increasingly, people can make things for themselves, producing a tool or artwork on the 3D printer, or publishing their own book on a digital file, or simply reading it on a tablet from the digital file. And they can also speed up communications about what they want made, or about finding and pricing what they want and having it delivered from the producer's store. At the root of the matter is the speed at which bits can be transformed into atoms, and atoms can be transformed back into bits. I point out that Whole Foods stock is down about 40% so far this year. They're taking tremendous competition. A lot of it is high-tech competition, and I posted one of the examples I used was Good Eggs, which is a website operation that operates here in San Francisco and several locations in California, among others. And what it does is it aggregates local farmer offerings and then delivers to the customer who orders online. So there's no need for a storefront. Everything's fresh. And it's clear from demand that the market is willing to pay quite a premium for fresh, healthy, local, including organic food. So Whole Foods is taking competition from a variety of different places. And you can see something like this, if it catches on, is really could be quite a competitive force. And of course, then there's Amazon, who plans to deliver to your door with drones. So the FAA has not approved that. That could take some time. But I think, 2020, the real race is on. The expectations for reengineering healthcare costs are very significant. I've pointed out that I think the healthcare industry, I mean, the Silicon Valley and the technology industry think they can re-engineer out over $1 trillion of labor costs in the healthcare and using healthcare apps and remote sensors and all sorts of different technologies. That's a very interesting question because one of the big drivers that has provided employment over the last two decades is healthcare. But that's another example. Another example is the payment systems, and I provide more information in the comic book about some of the numbers on the different payment systems. And I think the big, big push there is going to be the emerging market demand, and China's demand for razor-thin spreads is going to be a tsunami that slaps back into the Western world, and we're all going to be the benefit. I know, certainly, if you look at what we're doing at the Soleri store, we've been the beneficiary of PayPal having to cut in response to what Apple is doing, in response to what Alibaba is doing. So I look forward to some more cuts in our spreads. The fifth trend is commodities versus technology, and this is really stepping back and looking at the big picture because, and I described in the title, more atoms versus bits. we have a real dramatic tension in balancing between forces in the economy, which are inflationary, and then forces which are deflationary. And literally every week and every month, you'll see a variety of financial gurus debating, is this all going to be inflationary? Is this all going to be deflationary? So let's just walk through it, because it's really a question of, we have more people putting more stress on a limited or a finite space and shrinking natural resources. So that ought to be inflationary, pushing the price of commodities up. And to make that even worse, we have the central banks printing money, and so that ought to be more money and monetary policy, again, pushing inflation up. But we're not seeing inflation. If anything, we're seeing deflation. Well, part of that's a combination of factors. But one is, we have technology that reinvents how we use and distribute resources and makes it possible for us to go around the world and securitize all the different assets and flows. All of those things soak up a lot of the cash, and make tremendous deflationary forces, including outsourcing of labor. When you compete the global labor supply, it deflates the value of labor globally, and so also replacing labor with automation. So technology in a variety of ways can really offset. And so we're watching this back and forth about whether the stress on commodities is going to be offset some or more than by these changes in technology. So and the globalization, the rebalancing globally. I put up a link, wonderful example, because technology does not have to be high tech. It can be very low tech. A story of three 16-year-old Irish girls who won a 2014 science fair for coming up with enormous breakthrough in technique, planning technique that could really produce fantastic productivity increases in crop yields. It's quite amazing. It's an amazing story. But that's an example of a small sort of low-tech technology change that could have a very dramatic impact on lowering our footprint on the land and agricultural commodities. But it's a perfect example of all the kind of innovation that's going. I put up a chart in trend number 5 to show you the pricing on a group of different commodity ETFs. I used copper, gold, oil, and corn up against Apple and Amazon. And what you'll see is the companies who are centralizing flow tremendously into, you know, a few hands are getting a lot more stock market value than commodities, if anything. Commodity prices have really gotten clocked in most sectors, not all sectors, but most sectors this year, to the surprise of many. Trend number 6, energy continues to be a very, very important variable in the global economy. I put up a chart to show fossil fuels is still 87% of global energy consumption. We had a lot of interest in the last couple weeks in renewable energy. You've had Al Gore out saying that renewable energy is going to replace oil and gas. Now, the Rockefeller family got a lot of attention because the Rockefeller Brothers Fund said it was going to divest itself of fossil fuel investments. A lot of pressure and noise about the university endowments sort of disinvesting from oil and gas. The reality is, I would be amazed if they're really going to disinvest, or rather they're going to put their money in a variety of different vehicles that then turn around and do the investment for them. I think a lot of this is window dressing to sort of appeal to young people. And I would also bet that some of this is designed to try and lower the or raise the cost of capital to the Russians, because right now the United States and Russia are in quite a little squabble. And part of it is that the U.S., by a very tiny amount, is the number one owner controller of proved fossil fuel reserves globally. And Russia is a very close number two. And the reality is, as the Arctic becomes available, thanks to changes in the weather, there's a risk that Russia ends up as number one, which the U.S. is absolutely not going to tolerate. Big report out recently that the Russians working with Exxon have discovered more Arctic oil. So the Arctic is going to be a big area of competition. It's part of the politics of what's happening between Russia right now. But I put up a chart of the proved reserves and you'll see how close it is. One of the greatest series we've done on the Salieri Report is with Jim Norman about the oil card. If you haven't listened to that, it's one of the best series I know to make sense of what's really going on in the fossil fuel world around the globe. And add to that the interview we did with Ann Williamson, wonderful investigative reporter who was in Russia in the 90s and watched much of the backstory of the current politics in the Ukraine unfold, and does a marvelous job of explaining that. And if you listen to the series with Jim Norman and Ann Williamson, you will really understand what's going on with Russia. Add to that the story of the fracking technology moving into Europe now, and both what fracking has done for the domestic supply here and what it's going to do in Europe is dramatically going to change the politics of the Middle East. Everything we're doing is trying to bring bring Europe closer to us. So don't be surprised after the elections if there's a real push to get the trade agreements between Europe and the United States finished and bring them much, much closer. Now, despite the importance of fossil fuels in terms of total market share, there's no doubt that renewables are growing, and some very exciting things are going on in renewable technology that could really get solar, all of them, solar, geothermal, wind, really into the game in terms of competitiveness. So I would say between now, the next 5 years, you're just going to see renewable grow. And of course, on the margin, that's just clobbering the utilities, cash flows and stock market capitalizations, both in Europe. Utilities have done well in the United States in the beginning of this year, but I think there's real pressure on the utilities to try and use regulation to protect real monopoly business models and pricing. It's a losing game. It's an ugly game if you're one of the customers in the middle. But the reality is the utilities are stuck with a lot of expensive 2.0 technology and sunk costs. So expect for the big electric utilities to suffer. I put up a chart so you could see who the big guys are, both in Europe and the United States. Part of moving away and taking advantage of new technology and renewable energy technology is just doing it on a local level. And I put up a story we had on the blog about a German village who decided to just go out and do it. There's no reason we can't do that in America. You know, forget all the regulation, forget. I mean, just go do it. And yet it's been almost impossible to organize local groups to do it. Why? You and I can only posit. But as the slow burn eats away at the muscle of our economy, the local guys who figure out how to do that, the local guys who figure out how to do that are going to get a lot done. Watch the evolution of energy technology. Of course, the question always is how much breakthrough energy technology is going to be applied. We see examples around the world of cars that run on water and air. I put up a little video of the Tata's AirPod car, which is very interesting. Wired Magazine, interestingly enough, had an article on cold fusion. So, you know, the breakthrough energy technology seems to sort of peek through every once in a while. The reality is, even if the powers that be let that cat out of the bag, our infrastructure is deeply, deeply entwined into fossil fuels, and it will take one or two or several generations to sort of leapfrog. But keep an eye on what comes out, because it could be rather dramatic when it comes. Trend number 7 is education. There is absolutely a revolution going on in education. And this is, in a funny kind of way, very much like when I said there's a tsunami sort of coming back, a slapback from the emerging markets on financial spreads and payment systems. We're going to see the same slapback in education. And when it's coming, it's going to be a tsunami. Here's the reality. I put up a chart of college tuition and fees versus other prices. And the reality is education in the United States and in some parts of the developed world is one of the most outrageous monopoly and regulatory schemes that mankind has ever created. People are spending a fortune in time. I mean, forget the money. Kids are spending a fortune in their time sitting in classrooms and getting disinformation and curriculum that doesn't help them be successful in the world given the way it's going. And no one can afford to spend this much time and money, you know, having their desire to learn killed and not learning what they need to be successful in this world. It's just not possible. If you take a look at the numbers and the charts up on the blog, it's absolutely amazing. And then when you add to it that students are being asked to take on loans, and not just any kind of loans, but loans that cannot be extinguished in a bankruptcy, and they're being asked to do it when in fact they're being encouraged to study things for which, you know, there are no jobs that are going to be available. This is politically engineered entrapment. And I just had to put up the article I wrote on my former partner, William Diefendurfer, who I believe is absolutely guilty of financial genocide in connection with helping to engineer this political engineered entrapment. But anyway, the link is there. Here's the reality. We are building a global internet, and we are seeing websites go up that provide fantastic access for free to education. We have a variety of the big brand universities in the United States putting up their curriculum for free online. That means teachers all around the world can get access to that and use it to teach whatever they want, whenever they want. It's what Stuart Brand said, information wants to be free. And if you look at the quality of the materials that are now available and available at a relative cost advantage, what it means is that the opportunities for revolution in education have never been stronger. Now, I showed one chart that shows you in September 2014, so just last month, the number two category in terms of popularity, the Apple App Store for downloads, is education. Games is number one, but education is number two, bigger than business. That's amazing. So, you know, in Apple, if you look at what they're trying to do in education, the opportunities are for them are quite amazing. I pointed out, I put up the stock chart of two Chinese education companies that are publicly traded and how they did versus the S&P. They're going gangbusters. And I also put some of the articles about Western universities and who put their curriculum up and a little bit about some of their experience. Now, here's the profound question. If you're the G20, if your kid's in a remote village and you can get for free all the education at a place like Khan University online, you can get the curriculum at Harvard and Stanford or Wharton online, and you can proceed to use that curriculum to spend your time and your resources as efficiently as possible to get whatever it is you need to be competitive in this world, that means you can go right around the monopoly. And whereas your counterparts in America are spending 10 and 20,000 hours in their lifetime being dumbed down with curriculum like Common Core, you and the emerging markets don't have to waste your time on that. So we have a real situation where the kids in a poor village can be in a much better educational circumstance and get a much better education than kids in the wealthiest neighborhoods in America. That's not good. And one of the things you have to know about mothers is they're not going to tolerate their kids being put at that kind of disadvantage. If you look at the statistics on homeschooling, we've gone from a couple hundred thousand in 1988 to over 2 million just in 2010. And my guess is, I haven't seen the numbers after that, is it's skyrocketing because parents are not going to put up with this. They want their kids to be successful. And we're seeing this. I addressed this in my commentary on called Cotton Candy Land. You know, parents do not want their children to be naive if they're going to go out in the market and compete against the kids of oligarchs from the Ukraine and mobsters from the Chinese triads and the Japanese Yakuza, those kids are going to know how the world works. So parents in the United States do not want their kids to be dumbed down, waste enormous amounts of time in Common Core curriculum, and come out naive and get mowed down by kids from around the world. The last chart I put up was an example estimate of how many college graduates are currently in or is expected in 2020. And what you're going to see is you're going to have three times as many college graduates in China as you are in the United States. You're going to have more college graduates in India than the United States. So the competition is on, and the reality is, I really encourage you to take a look at some of the charts and graphs in the education section. And whoever you are, whatever you're doing, you need to rethink education for you and the people you love, because if you look at what is accessible globally, if we're going to stay competitive, we're going to have to rethink about education. We're going to have to find ways of blowing by the monopolies or reinventing the monopolies in our life. We can't afford to spend 20 or 30,000 hours digesting irrelevant disinformation. It's not going to work. Trend number eight, war, the biggest business. I wanted to walk you through sort of the different defense spending. We're now spending almost $2 trillion a year for global annual military expenditures. If you look at what's going on, it's clear the divide and conquer politics are hot and heavy to make sure that there's plenty of foreign purchases and plenty of wars for defense spending. If you look at any measure of defense contractor stocks, they're outperforming the S&P since 9/11, like no tomorrow. So the reality is we are as we move to try and create a global empire, global government, the role of force becomes bigger and bigger and more profitable. This is going to be made particularly gruesome by technology. I put up some of the numbers on the global drone market. One way to cut costs is to do more and more with robots and drones. And then, of course, there's all the sort of covert wars and now what's called soft revolutions. We see it again now with what's happening in Hong Kong. Although it's clear from the way the Chinese are dealing with it, they're much more savvy about how entrainment technology can do this and how to manage it. It's quite interesting to watch. We had a Salieri report this year with Charles Smith on soft revolutions because I think it's such an important topic. But we're seeing war in all different forms now with the sanctions of the U.S. Treasury sort of developed and applied to Russian leaders, even to members of the Chinese army. But I think the one that takes the cake is the military invasion of Africa to attack the Ebola virus. I even though there's been a flag waving about Ebola in the United States and the possibility of an outbreak, I still expect this to be a primarily African phenomena as the United States moves to make sure it's dominant in the investment interests in Africa. In many respects, Africa is the last big pile of natural resources to compete for. And a lot of frontier markets that are going to be very, very valuable over the next 20 or 30 years. So the competition is on, and I think the effort to make a big deal out of Ebola is very much an excuse to send in military forces and do a variety of other things to make sure that the United States comes out number one. And I'm sure everybody at the Bohemian Grove is very, very happy that they engineered somebody in the presidency who looks like he's half African. Anyway, the question about war brings up the age-old question of the central banking warfare model and the dependency of the U.S. dollar on the success of the military and the costs of that in many different ways. And this brings back the old question for which Salieri was created, which is how do we come up with a more virtuous model? We're clearly going to have to, and that means a shift in global consciousness and efforts by multiple people in multiple countries to bring transparency, including to the black budget and the UFO issues, because one of the primary concerns about the war machine is the war machine trying to control the human race, or are they concerned about controlling someone or something else? And you can't answer that question until we start to really answer the questions behind the black budget. But war continues to be a big business, and all indications are for the near future, it's going to get bigger. So hold on to your hat. Space, the final frontier. I want to read a story that I love from Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett is also has often pointed out that airline investors have, in the aggregate, never made money on manned success at flight. Quote, thanks to Wilbur and Orville Wright and their adventures on the Outer Banks, North Carolina is known as first in flight. But Buffett didn't let that history stop him from making a sarcastic remark about investors' attitude toward the Wrights. Quote, if there had been a capitalist down there, the guy would have shot down Wilbur, Buffett said. Quote, one small step for mankind and one huge step for capitalism. That's a reference to fact if you go back to the days of Wilbur and Orville Wright and you look at the collective gains and losses of all investors since then, we really haven't made any money on airlines. So here's the question. Now that we're going into space, is an investment matter, is this a chance for the investors to finally turn a profit, or is this simply a way to double or triple down on losing money on flight as we go into the next phase? Anyway, whatever the economics are, the space investment is first and foremost about facilitating and controlling the politics and economics down below on planet Earth. And one of the most important reasons for that is as the money and transaction moves onto the internet platform and more people have smartphones and are dependent on telecommunications, the importance of the satellite system grows. Because so a lot of the transactions that are flying around on planet Earth are in fact flying around in space around planet Earth. And that is what is making the satellite systems, the management, governance, ownership, and control of the satellite system so important, because you're talking about the train tracks for the development of new digital currency and payment systems. So there's some very interesting charts to give you a sense of the satellites, and I think part of the United States' power is its clear dominance in that area. You can also see, and this is an important point for both defense spending, but I put up NASA spending as well, it is so significant, the dependence of every economy and every state on military and related sort of government agency spending. You want to keep that in mind. You're seeing more and more announcements of corporations indicating their interest to participate in space. We now have 7 spaceports around the country, but it's scheduled to go up to 17 in several years. Of course, more and more private companies providing services and proposing to provide tourism services into space. A big article in the Wall Street Journal the other day announcing Japan's tech giants turn to outer space for growth. Quote, NEC, retreating from smartphones and semiconductors, is expanding its satellite business. And a Japanese firm announced that it was going to build a space elevator by 2050, made possible, of course, by the expected developments in graphene and other material sciences that are quite interesting. Japan, very much a leader in that area, as well as the South Koreans. One of the big areas is going to be creating the legal framework for the commercial exploration of space. It's really not in place. And the management and enforcement issues, I think, are going to offer a lifetime of opportunities for attorneys and tax experts. One of the most sensitive issues, of course, is space weapons. And I put up a link to an article on the top 10 space weapons. So not only is space the place where you provide for some of the telecommunication networks that really drive the global payment and currency systems and communication systems, but you also have weaponry that can determine who really controls in space. You can also, you know, they're also talking about solar farms and all sorts of other stuff. keep an eye on the efforts to start human colonies on Mars. The efforts are clearly underway. I put a link up to one of the areas on NASA's website, Mission to Mars. If you look at the interest that's being generated by the corporate and popular media trying to interest young people in space, we're clearly on our way. I remember when the Kennedy administration was promoting space travel, and we really thought it was going to happen then in the 60s and 70s, and of course it got shut down after the Kennedy assassination, or wound down after the Kennedy assassination, but we're seeing it really rev up for the first time since then. One of my favorite quotes from Bob Dean is, "It's the destiny of the children in my family to travel the stars." So I think it's a good thing. I think it's time to get out there and see what's out there. I put up a couple of articles on the opportunity for us to start a vacation in space. So I asked the question of all of you to kind of help you get ready for the kind of change that's coming up. Are you ready to plan your first trip to the moon? If you want to take one, the opportunity is going to be there. Trend number 10, transportation and infrastructure. Rebalancing the global economy means there's a lot more movement around the planet, both of goods and services and people. And particularly business travel, we're seeing tremendous increases in world air traffic. Remember, you've got 4 billion people in Asia. If that's where the strong growth rates, then you're going to see a lot more air travel. And we certainly are seeing it. I put up a chart with one of the estimates of where we're going to be in 2029. It's quite remarkable. Remember, as the global middle class grows, then you have more people who can afford to do that kind of travel. But in particular, you have more people who can afford to purchase cars. Now, this is a big problem because if you look at the projections on urbanization and the so-called trend of megacities, we've got an explosion of urban areas with more than 10 million people. And there's no way that you can handle the traffic if everybody can afford to and wants to buy a car. You can imagine the sort of steel piling up all over the planet. So the question is, what are we going to do about this? I put up a fabulous cover from Popular Science on the future of the car that came out. It's the October issue, but it came out last month. And you just see enormous discussion and innovation around cars, from cars that run on water and cars that run on air that are tiny, or driverless cars or networked cars, or sharing cars like Zipcars or sharing rides. Uber is just taking off. I've been amazed at how many very financially secure, successful people I find who love taking Uber. If you haven't done it, if you don't know what Uber is, it's a sort of the Airbnb of taxi cabs. So private parties give rides to, they're vetted by Uber in a variety of ways, both the car and the people, and they give rides to people in lieu or in place of the taxi cab services, and it's become quite popular. Anyway, I noted how well Tesla has done, or the Tesla stock compared to the car ETF or the S&P, and that graphs up. Railroads, I believe, have real potential to be the workhorse of Global 3.0. Certainly, we've seen tremendous beginning of reinvestment in the train network in the United States. Part of that is, of course, the use of the trains to carry some of the oil and gas coming out of the Balkans. But I think there's tremendous potential for global train. The Japanese offered to lend the U.S. half the cost of a super maglev train. That was after the Tesla founder Elon Musk proposed we needed maglev trains around the United States. China is intimating they may build an undersea train to America. That would be amazing if you could get the 4 billion people in Asia being able to take high-speed train back and forth to North America. That would have a very dramatic impact. I must tell you, I think that those kind of high-speed underground rail operations already exist. If you haven't seen Richard Dolan's presentation on underground and under-ocean operations, I really recommend it because I think it's a very critical part of the Global 3.0 infrastructure that's already in place. You hear much in the press about the fact that in North America, we didn't invest in the infrastructure. And we haven't invested in infrastructure. I disagree. I think we've made fantastic investments of infrastructure. They're just secret. But Dolan's presentation based on Richard Souder's research is quite interesting. It was up on the blog, and you can link to it from the discussion of this trend. The global infrastructure spending is really underpacing commercial development. So you have investment in all sorts of commercial enterprises. They need a good infrastructure platform to operate, and they're pushing. They're constantly pushing beyond the infrastructure, and the infrastructure is trying to catch up. The other thing that's happening is we need real investment infrastructure that is restorative of the environment. There's an incredible opportunity to restore the environment in a way that can create enormous equity values, particularly as we securitize the economic activities globally. And so I would love to see that happen. If we have to, we may even have to crowdfund it. I put up the link to Solar Freaking Roadways, one of our most popular crowdfunds that we participated in this quarter. We participated in a fair amount of crowdfunding and Kiva campaigns. So a lot of good stuff, but Solar Freaking Roadways, if we have to crowdfund it, we will. Trend number 11, manufacturing renaissance. I covered this in my interview with Jim Poplava on megatrends. And I've done a lot with Jim Norman about talking about what domestic energy and technology is doing to help really bring manufacturing back into the United States. It's very exciting. Unfortunately, it's not going to create very many jobs. And so you're talking about something where labor is very highly automated. But again, it's this concept of atoms going to bits and bits going back to atoms much, much faster. Nanotechnology is a part of that. We need to do a Solari report on nanotechnology, so I'm not going into it tonight. But there's a lot going on in this area. And I think part of it, Joseph Farrell and I believe that part of the manufacturing renaissance is, if you look at the black budget issues, the breakaway civilization issues, the national security issues, and all sorts of intellectual capital issues, there's a decision, I think, to bring things back into North America and the Anglo-American alliance for much, much tighter control, and not necessarily share them with Asia as the competition gets sterner and the Chinese manufacturing companies really mature and grow into serious global competitors. So some of this is just pulling that intellectual capital back into home base and being much more careful, particularly, I think, with space-related investments. So I think things are going to be brought a little bit closer to home, and companies are not going to take the kind of risk that they have to take in terms of long supply lines when the geopolitics can get tense. So manufacturing renaissance, trend number 11, very interesting. Finally, one that we're going to be talking a lot about at the event in Menlo Park is My Expectation. I called 12 So Much Life. Let me just read it to you. The most powerful war on planet Earth is occurring in the spiritual realms, and it spills into our cultural wars and the choices we make in everyday life. The Old Testament in Deuteronomy says, quote, "I call heaven and earth to record this day against you, that I've set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore, choose life, that both thou and thy seed may live." And we're seeing this life and death struggle. You know, the war is coming down to the most intimate level. We're all struggling with it every day. So the question is, are we going to eat GMO food that could seriously make us sick and ensure that our children may not be fertile? And or are we going to resist and buy and focus on really fresh food? So are we going to resist the toxicity levels and mind control that can come through vaccines, fluoride, pharmaceutical drugs, or instead choose natural nutrition and preventative methods and do everything we can to maintain strong immune systems and low toxicity levels? Are we going to incorporate and digest a lot of brainwashing from corporate media or entrainment technologies that come through certain kinds of media, both TV and internet? Or are we going to try and find authentic sources of information? Obviously, I know where you stand on this already because you're listening to this Larry Report, but you see this choice of life and death and so many of the actions that we take every day. And it's very much a new environment in the last 20 years for many Americans to face the fact that there are so many efforts by government and large corporations to market things to you, which are basically significantly or have the potential to significantly lower your life expectancy. And it feels like a very predatory environment, because it is. Obviously, part of this is technology gets much more invasive. And so we have some pretty truly gruesome and fantastic visions of where things like biotechnology or transhumanism can take us. And it's this intense competition between choosing life and death and the marketing of life and death that is making our environment so unusual. And I wanted to come up with a title for this trend. I chose So Much Life, and I'll tell you the story where I got it. It comes from one of my favorite Bear McCreary songs from Battlestar Galactica called So Much Life. At the very end of Battlestar Galactica, as they have successfully led their people to a new home on Earth, Admiral Adama asks his, now his love, once upon a time his colleague, President Roslin, if she wants to see the wildlife of the Earth closer. He takes her, they get into a Raptor, a small spaceship, and fly across the African continent at very low altitude, right above the ground, so they can see all of the wildlife. It's quite beautiful. And during the flight, as she's admiring the abundance of Earth, she utters her last words, "So much life." And indeed, on planet Earth, that's what we have. We have so much life and so much truly beautiful life. And ultimately, the question of life and death and what happens on this planet comes down to what each one of us choose. And of course, one of the reasons we're gathering in Menlo Park is to talk about, okay, how do we choose to live a free and inspired life? Because that is, as each one of us chooses that, we give life and possibility to all the other life on Earth. So those are our 12 trends. Let me just go through them again quickly. This is the shift to Global 3.0, rebalancing the global economy, finance and investment, transforming to 3.0. 3 is building out the global network. 4 is reengineering delivery, succeeding in atoms and bits. 5 is commodities versus technology, more atoms and bits. 6 is energy. 7 is the revolution in education. 8 is war, the biggest business. 9 is space, the final frontier. 10 is transportation and infrastructure. 11, manufacturing renaissance. And 12, so much life. At the bottom of our comic book, we put links to the other two wrap-ups, quarterly wrap-ups and the annual wrap-up at the beginning of the year. I think those comic books can also inform you about these and some of the other trends. We also put up links to the reports that we perform that we published in the third quarter. And then we're adding links for the commentaries that I wrote during, or some of the other members of the team wrote during third quarter. And all of that is designed, again, to help you build a map that can help you navigate this environment and really find the pathway to build your free and inspired life. And I will tell you again, as I said at the beginning, the changes we've seen in the last 10 or 20 years are just the beginning. Strap on in, get ready to take off in warp drive, because the changes are going to accelerate. But in those changes, there's plenty of opportunity for you and me. And I think what we all have to ask ourselves is, how can we be of service to the people around us and our fellow humans around the planet? Where is the opportunity for you? And I hope that this third quarter wrap-up has helped you think about it and ultimately will help you find it and take advantage of it. Okay, so that's it for the wrap-up. Let me just talk a little bit about what's coming up. We have gotten tremendous requests now for, it's been growing for about a year. And when I was in Albuquerque, I got a chance to talk to a lot of subscribers about it to address the topic of spiritual warfare. So we're going to do so with Franklin Sanders next week on October 9th. I'm very excited about it. Franklin is my pastor at Christ Our Hope Church. And he's promised me we're free to disagree. We debate these issues. So that's going to be a lively one. And I think one, because Franklin and I really believe we have had the opportunity to be overcomers in a great deal of spiritual warfare. So it's a topic very near and dear to our heart, one we enjoy talking about. Then the following week, very exciting, a wonderful chef in the San Francisco Bay Area, expert on fermentation, nutritionist Karen Diggs, who's had a remarkably successful Kickstarter campaign. And it's a great opportunity to talk about what are the ingredients of a successful campaign to crowdfund. How do you do it? Of course, this is the non-equity, this is the sort of donation or sell a product kind of crowdfunding, but we need to start there. Remarkable story. I don't want to give it away, but it just shows you what can be done. You never know until you try. And this one was Karen went in looking, I think, for $38,000 and came out with $186,000. It's quite remarkable. One of the Kickstarter campaigns we participated in the third quarter. And then the following week, I asked John Rappaport, it was his quarterly turn, and I said to him, you know, everybody wants to talk about spiritual warfare, and what amazes me is that I, as a Christian, always come out in exactly the same place as you, but we use different terminology and come at it slightly different. So would you do one on spiritual warfare, but completely from your point of view? I'm sure he'll come up with a different topic or name for it than that. So we're going to do some spiritual warfare in October, first with Franklin, and then John's going to do one on his own. So until next week with Franklin, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.